And, of course, our special guest tonight is none other than Richard C. Hoagland of TheEnterpriseMission.com. Revamped book, by the way, Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA. It is a doozy. All of Richard's information you can find at darkmission.com or darkmission.net or enterprisemission.com. We've got those linked up at Coast to Coast AM for you. Richard, do you subscribe to the old theory that perhaps mankind went to the moon millions of years ago in with advanced technology that we have since lost?
Well, it's not an old theory. It's our theory. What we're looking at in the solar system, all the stuff that NASA hasn't told us about is our stuff, our ancient stuff. And if you look at that and really begin to understand the implications, which are pretty astonishing and off the edge of the paper, it makes sense now that the people who we're supposed to be trusting and paying attention to, and they're supposed to be giving us the data that our tax dollars are paying for, they're keeping it to themselves because they believe they are the appropriate stewards or inheritors, or what's that legal term for when you have a legacy and you're the one that's supposed to get it? And the rest of us aren't. They believe, these people who have been doing this, and I'm more and more convinced of this now, they believe they have a God-given right, almost like the divine right of kings, to look at that stuff as their stuff, and the rest of us don't count. And you asked at the top of the show if I have evolved in my perception of this whole situation. Yeah, I mean, originally I thought we were dealing with a lot of very dumb people who could look at this data and not see what's obviously blatantly, plainly visible, you know, plain as day on these images and on the files and in terms of what's now been posted on the web. But no, it is a conscientious, consistent, deliberate campaign, a policy to keep the good stuff for themselves, and we pay for it, and they get to use it, benefit from it, understand it, research it, go back, exploit it. Does this sound vaguely familiar in terms of other things going on in our culture right now?
Almost everything, Rich.
Yeah. I mean, where are the trillions of dollars that we're giving to these banks going? Well, they at least have the guts to say, none of your damn business. NASA pretends to be on our side. And when I say NASA, remember, I'm not talking about 99% of the rank and file of the 18,000 employees of NASA who are left after the 500,000 of the so-called Apollo years. I'm talking about leadership. I'm talking about the people who pull the strings, the people at the top, the people who set policy, the people who claim to do one thing and are doing another. I mean, I'm really getting ticked off by this because it's gone on and on and on. And in the area I know exquisitely well, I can show you the lies that have been told consistently now over the last 40 years. I mean, this anniversary coming up, I'm having very, very mixed feelings. Because on the one hand, I think back to those halcyon days when Cronkite and, you know, Bill and all the other guys that I work with covered this astonishing human achievement.
It was also Frank McGee for NBC.
Frank McGee was for NBC. Yeah. What do you got, a whole list of guys there? You're going to poke them out all night?
As people send them to me, I'm passing them on to you.
Well, let's not miss anybody then, folks. Keep sending those cards and letters to George. But, you know, I'm really kind of conflicted because I know now that the program that we covered was a lie, an out-and-out blatant lie, planned from the beginning to be a lie, to be a version of the truth, but not the truth. And the conflict comes in when we're approaching this anniversary, and I see a story a couple of days ago in, I think it was the Sunday Express in London, that NASA had suddenly, miraculously, just a few days before the 40th anniversary, George, guess what?
What?
They found the missing Apollo 11 videotape.
Exactly. We talked about that. It was unbelievable.
Isn't it? Now, look,
talking about this for years, haven't we?
Well, we broke the story. We broke the story on Coast that they were missing. And And then we tried to get some people to write email Mike Griffin. And then we reported on this program that there was a consistent campaign in headquarters to keep him from seeing the emails. The NASA administrator, the guy that President Bush had appointed to be head of his space agency, was being kept from the people who were basically asking him, where are the damn tapes? So now we fast forward the film, and just a few days before the 40th anniversary, these original versions of the black and white video that we all saw 40 years ago, the evening of July 20th, have been found, and NASA is kind of being very circumspect about what they plan to do, but the word is that there's going to be some kind of a major showing around the anniversary, like, oh, didn't this happen just in time? Now, on the plus side, the quality of what we're going to see is going to be really impressive. You're going to finally be able to really see the astronauts, the lunar module, the lunar surface, the sun, the reflections, the shadows, the equipment they're putting up, you know, Aldrin testing his center of gravity in 1/6 lunar gravity, that kind of thing. The downside is they've had God knows how many years with advancing computer technology to expunge any interesting anomaly in the background from these videos so that it will conform with the NASA pre-sold version of what the moon is supposed to be about.
Well, of course. They're not going to let those things out without examining them.
I'm talking more than examining. I'm talking sanitation. I'm talking expunging. I'm talking, you know, you'd never recognize the moon that's really there based on these videos, but they will be purported to be the original, pristine, oh, look what we found in the vault down in Australia where they've been gathering dust for 40 years. The other thing that is going to happen is that one of the two unmanned missions that were just launched a couple weeks ago, called LRO, Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, has now been put into its almost final mapping orbit. It's moving between 100 and some miles and I think 30 miles above the moon right now. And they're obviously going to be taking high-quality, incredible resolution images from orbit looking down of the Apollo 11 landing site. And they will then make those photographs available, and you will see, finally, after all these years, proof from NASA that indeed we did land on the moon.
Of course, what will the skeptics say who don't believe we went to the moon?
Well,
Photoshop,
that,
right?
That contingent, that group of people that were kind of looked at to be the ones that were dangerous because they might ask questions, they've already been bought and paid for with the fake conspiracy. Nothing you could do would convince those people. They remind me of certain other political groups that we ever really went to the moon. No matter what evidence is provided, they are mostly locked up in the fake conspiracy, while they've been completely derailed from investigating the real conspiracy, which is what did Neil and Buzz really see that required those videotapes to go missing for 40 years until the computer technology was developed where they could be sanitized safely with no
football,
no fingerprints.
Interesting. But you're right. The Bart Sobrels will never be convinced that we went to the moon.
So where are we? Well, we stand at a crossroads because the one unknown factor in this entire equation is the election of Barack Obama. Now, I know you and I are having increasing differences on his presidency, even only 167 days in.
Well, I don't like the economic stimulus programs. I think that all this is going to bite us sooner than later.
Yeah,
so that's my major issue. That's my major issue.
Assuming that everything is as it's represented.
True.
And as we know, certainly you and I know from this show, very few things are as represented. So I'm willing to wait and see how this plays out for another, let's say, 6 months. I mean, a year is a fairly good measure of where an administration is really going these days.
I'm also baffled at how, like, World Net Daily, which has done some great stories and some other off-the-wall things, just keeps pounding away at this birth certificate story, yeah. And the other media really doesn't even touch it. Whether he's got one or not, it's not the case right now. It's the fact that you've got people now signing petitions, Richard, that want to get to the bottom of this.
Well, I think in the fullness of time, that will all be very interestingly resolved. And I have a private theory as to what's really going on, but it's kind of a distraction from this evening. So
right, yeah, and we don't have time for that. That's not the issue.
We have limited time.
Go ahead.
Well, the positive thing about Obama, which I want to call everybody's attention, again, looking at it from my perspective, covering the NASA waterfront, the space frontier, the things that are really going to affect the fate of civilization, is what he has done with NASA. Because what did he do? What was interesting to me during the transition is that when Obama was elected, and then you have this interminable wait until the president actually takes office, which these days is really crazy. I mean, why we don't do this on a more expedited timescale? It used to be, remember back before 1933, the president was elected in March. He was elected in November, but he wasn't inaugurated until March. It was FDR that moved it up to January 20th. Well, now, even, you know, November, December, January, that's an eternity. That's a lifetime. You remember the old cliche that, you know, a day is a lifetime in politics?
Absolutely.
Well, at the rate at which the world is moving, the rate at which we're all interconnected, the rate at which the economies propagate the stock market bad news around the world, from Tokyo to New York to London, et cetera, you can't have this three-month wait between electing a new administration and the new administration taking office. So what we saw was, during the transition, we saw a kind of a really expedited transition to where we kind of had, for a while, like they have in Russia now, we had two presidents. We had George Bush acknowledging the new president and really making things as smooth as possible in a way that was said by many observers to be unprecedented in terms of moving the new people in and the old people out and all that. Well, as part of that transition, remember how smooth it went in every department, every agency of this incredibly vast and complicated government,
yes,
the most complicated government on the planet. What was the one agency where Obama had problems?
NASA.
Exactly. And what was it that Mike Griffin, head of NASA, appointed by Bush, did that made me certainly go, oh, this is intriguing? He told Obama's official representative, a gal named Lori Garver, who has now been nominated by the president to be the deputy NASA administrator, but who was head of Obama's NASA transition team, he basically told her she wasn't smart enough to evaluate his, i.e. Griffin's, space program. Remember that?
Yeah, I do. I do remember that.
Okay,
kind of arrogant, wasn't it?
It was incredibly. Particularly, you know, it was also impolitic. Forget the arrogance. But here's a guy whose wife simultaneously, I'm talking about Griffin now, was campaigning, sending emails to a bunch of very influential congressmen and senators who will ultimately have to approve of the new administrator, campaigning within the aerospace community to have her husband, Mike Griffin, kept on as the NASA administrator. Now, that's not going to happen when you basically kick in a delicate part of the anatomy the president's official, you know, envoy and tell her that she's not smart enough to basically darn your socks. So what was his game? What was the agenda? It was almost like he was flagging that NASA was something the president should pay attention to. Remember, nothing is as it appears on the surface. The lie is different at every level. And when you see a smart guy, I mean, Griffin has 5 degrees, right?
He's been
around NASA and politics for most of his professional life. Do you really think that's how he thought a guy who wants to continue to be administrator should comport himself with the new president?
But you never trusted him from the get-go.
Well, I was, you know, I'm back to Reagan, you know, trust but verify. I was willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. Remember, early on, I said he made some really smart decisions, like saving Voyager. Remember that?
I remember that.
And he did several other things, like he reinstated the Hubble rescue mission, which turned, I mean, talk about gold. That telescope is a brand new 21st century space telescope because Mike Griffin said, overturning Sean O'Keefe, no, we're going to go and fix it. And he stuck with it, and he made it happen, and he produced a shuttle that was reasonably safe so the astronauts could go up and do that and not get killed. And it all worked, and he absolutely deserves 100% credit for those important decisions. The dumb thing he did, the amazingly weird dumb thing he did, was championing the so-called Constellation program, spending $6.5 billion on the Ares new rocket to replace the shuttle, which doesn't have a prayer of really flying because it's got so many problems and it's so over budget and behind schedule, and it has left us now with a five-year gap between the time the shuttle program is supposed to end, which is next year, according to President Bush's schedule, and the time that the new spacecraft and the new boosters to continue the manned space effort or the human space effort is going to go into orbit, which will not be until 2015. A five-year gap where the only way we're going to be able to get to our own space station is by bumming a ride with Putin. I'm sorry, with Medvedev.
Well, yeah, but even, you know, you just made the same faux pas that the president
did. It's because everybody, and I have a funny story to tell you. Well, let me tell the story now.
Couple minutes, go ahead.
What's very interesting is, you know, a few days ago, before our president, President Obama, went to Moscow, I was suddenly invited by this major Moscow magazine published by TASS, which is the official Russian news agency, remember?
The Russians like you for some reason.
They wanted me to do an op-ed piece, which is going to appear. It was supposed to appear before Obama arrived. I was informed tonight that it will appear next week as a kind of a perspective on the meeting between the two presidents and the prime minister, Putin. And they've asked me now to add to my op-ed piece, which is really interesting. Why is it interesting? Because I believe that Obama's attention was called specifically to NASA as a problem child in the transition by Griffin as a strategy, that he knew exactly what he was doing, and he knew that it would get attention, and he wants the new president to focus on what's going on in NASA, because the NASA that he hands off is not the NASA that he wanted to hand off. That, in fact, the entire Ares constellation debacle has been something he was forced to do, but in fact may not have wanted to do if he'd had complete discretion. Nothing else makes sense. So what does Obama do when he finally gets the message? He appoints a special blue ribbon presidential commission, the Norm Augustine Commission, to hold hearings and to do in-depth studies and research and report back to the president by early August, that's like a month away, on the state of the human spaceflight program and his constellation, the best way to go back to the moon and on to Mars. And Obama bit the bullet, and in all the agencies, the only one where he's having a major top-to-bottom review is the one that is the most important for the future of mankind, NASA.
Back in a moment. After Dark magazine comes out every month, full color. It is wonderful, part of Coast to Coast. Lots of folks write for it. Call 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505. Or you can go online to get After Dark at coasttocoastam.com. And we're back with Richard C. Hoagland. Richard, what's your take on Ed Grimsley, Mr. Night Vision Goggles himself?
Well, I have a first-person witness, as you know, someone whom I trust in terms of her judgment and perceptions and all that. We kind of talked about her at the top of the show. Her name is Dr. Robin Falkov. And she, last year at the Tesla conference, which I'm going to get back to in a second, actually looked through Grimsley's $3,000-plus you know, infrared night vision. Third generation. And saw strange stuff. She also saw some things without the goggles, which was even more intriguing to me. But you've actually seen the same thing. Used the goggles.
I've seen two very bizarre things that night.
Yep. The thing is that if there is a secret space program, if NASA and the other programs that we see on the planet, the Chinese, the Russians, the Japanese, the Indians, everybody doing this stuff with rockets, if we're kind of like the second tier, you know, we're not the first string, we're the folks that have to kind of plod along and do it with Newtonian physics because the real physics has been deliberately kept from us. I mean, to me, this is what this seems to be shaping up to be in terms of a ultimate reality. That we almost have, and this is going to be an interesting idea I want to explore in the next hour and a half. It's almost like that civilization, George, has bifurcated, that we have split into those of us that have been confined to Earth, except for these little primitive, you know, puking little rocket thingies that they let us play with. Ah, you're laughing.
Yes, I'm chuckling.
And then there's the guys that have all the cool stuff, the HD physics, the anti-grav technology, the unlimited free energy, the pollutionless power, the endless materials, the diamonds as cheap as sawdust. Those people really have a separate civilization. Remember, I told you I wanted to think outside the box tonight.
Yep.
And they are running their own show, and they kind of occasionally allow us to play in their sandbox. You know, they let us send these little probes to Venus or to the moon or to Saturn and send back these pretty pictures, and they let the scientists play at their little games, you know, analyzing stuff, whereas in fact, there are human beings wearing extraordinary spacesuits, walking on the moons of Saturn, looking into the incredible crevices of Iapetus, reading the ancient libraries of human beings who were fantabulous millennia, thousands of millennia, millions of millennia ago, and we are not supposed to know anything that this is going on. That is the model that I want to present for consideration, as Rod Serling would say, for your consideration in the Twilight Zone.
Ingo Swann, father of modern-day remote viewing, claims that he saw structures on the backside of the moon in a remote viewing session.
Yes. Oh, and isn't that a great segue?
Go ahead.
Because something is not quite right with the plan. They just launched these two new missions called LRO, Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and LaCrosse, LCROSS, on the same rocket. And they have kind of dualistic and complementary missions. LRO, as I said a few minutes ago, has gone into orbit now and is going to be in the position in the next few days to take the first high-resolution views of the Apollo 11 and all the other Apollo landing sites and the Ranger crashes and the Russian probes and all the other stuff that's been placed up there in the last 50 years by various nations. And they are going to probably release some pretty interesting imagery showing that, in fact, there is a descent stage of the lunar module. There are backpacks. They won't be able to see the flag. It's too small. But they will probably be able to see the lunar module with even the shadows of the legs sitting there where Buzz and Neil left on that morning, the morning after the night before, when they had landed on July 20th on the moon. That timing of all this happening right now is really interesting because the second mission of the LRO kind of compendium, the LaCrosse side of it, as you know, is supposed to put a spacecraft, a 5,000-pound rocket booster called a Centaur, controlled by this little LaCrosse shepherding spacecraft to which it's still attached, into this very elongated orbit such that in about 4 months, in October of this year, actually after the new revised edition of Dark Mission goes to print and comes out, you know, on the front tables at various bookstores, that spacecraft, LaCrosse, is going to impact the moon in a very dynamic and, they're telling us, maybe even visible from Earth event.
So around October 9th or so.
October 9th, the morning of October 9th. In fact, it's going to be 4:30 in the morning your time in Los Angeles when this thing hits.
Okay.
And what we're going to do when we get closer is, you know, I will come on and I will instruct this audience how they can go out with their own telescopes and set them up and look literally from probably the Mississippi River west, because that's where it's going to be dark still. And they will actually maybe be able to see this with a telescope. Under a very interesting scenario, they may even be able to see it with the naked eye, and we'll get to that in a minute. The precursor to this was the fact that the La Crosse mission, which is this kind of separate piggyback mission on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter launch the other day, went to the moon and did a duck under the South Pole and got flung into this very elongated orbit, which is a 38-day orbit. It takes 38 days for it to go around the Earth once, and it will go around once, twice, three times, and on the fourth time, they'll smack it into one of these sunless craters near the South Pole of the moon, ostensibly looking for ice, looking for water which has frozen in the bottom of that crater and has not seen the light of day for literally, as Carl would say, billions and billions of years. And that water, if they find it, will be the absolute life's blood of the project to return to the moon and set up a base and to begin a true solar system civilization. But it's not being done with HD technology and physics and anti-gravity and all that. It's going to be done with rockets. It's going to be done in the conventional, slow, plodding way. Now, when the spacecraft, La Crosse, ducked under the moon a few nights ago in the wee hours of June 23rd, they were calibrating the cameras and the instruments on board. We have posted tonight on the Enterprise Mission website, enterprisemission.com, which I was able to get up there just before airtime, a part one of a couple-part paper that I'm going to write over the next day or so. So you got to come back after you read part one. You got to come back for part two. Because what the La Crosse team, which is based out of NASA Ames near San Francisco on the West Coast, appears to have done is they appear to have leaked the first bona fide official NASA evidence of ancient structures on the moon.
This is incredible. Plus, I've got to tell you, your buddy Jerry Purnell, the science fiction writer and science writer, just sent me an email, and he just wanted you to know that he had one of those mimeograph sheets with the flag in it.
Did he keep it?
No. He said it's gone.
Oh, damn, Jerry.
He said it's long gone.
Oh.
He's been listening to the show, and he says, Richard's an old friend, and maybe he's got it right.
But he remembers it.
He remembers it.
Well, I have a witness then.
Yes, well, and it's Jerry Purnell.
I mean, Jerry and I go back, God, even before Marconi.
He'd be glad to know that.
No, that's amazing that Jerry remembered, because he was one of the hordes that descended on JPL to cover the mission. Well, Jerry has a network. I mean, everybody now is connected through Facebook.
Oh, Jerry has a great network,
yeah,
by the way.
So what we need, Jerry, if you're listening...
Oh, he's listening.
We need for you to find, maybe Larry Niven preserved his. You know, somebody preserved that little mimeo thing, because there was the genesis of this stupid lie that we never went to the moon. And it would be so nice to nail this up on the wall and write fini to that nonsense and to look at the real conspiracy, which is what NASA now has leaked. Now, here's what's gone down. After that early morning pass under the moon, La Crosse was moving away from the moon into this very elongated orbit. You can see all these diagrams on the EnterpriseMission.com website. They looked back, and they took about an hour's worth of data, ultraviolet, infrared, visible light, mm-hmm. spectrometers, you know, calibrating the instruments with the real moon. What this instrumentation is going to be used for in October is they're going to zoom in really close, following about 50,000 miles behind the Centaur rocket, which they cut free. The rocket slams into the moon at almost 2 miles per second. And then the La Crosse spacecraft, the so-called shepherding spacecraft, which is loaded with all these instruments, is watching and recording and transmitting back to Earth in real time the data of the huge plume of dirt and dust and maybe ice kicked up from the bottom of one of these shadowed craters.
Will this be a bigger plume than the Japanese craft that hit?
Yes. Okay. Because it's a much heavier spacecraft. And the kinetic energy goes up as the square of velocity, and this thing is coming in excess of the escape velocity of the moon, whereas the Selene Japanese spacecraft was in orbit around the moon. It's also going to be an almost vertical dive between 70 and 80 degrees, which is a whisker away from 90, directly into the moon. So all the facets of the mission are maximized for the maximum bang for the buck.
Alfred Weber thinks we're bombing it.
Alfred Weber is nuts. I'm going to say it coast to coast. Alfred Weber is nuts. But he provided a very interesting scenario that seems to be a variant of something that I'm going to propose tonight that's going to make Weber's scenario look like a Sunday school picnic.
And you call him nuts?
Wait till you hear what I have to say.
Before we jump on you, huh?
So the La Crosse spacecraft is following about 50,000 miles behind the Centaur empty rocket stage. The rocket stage slams into the moon, kicks up in their model a plume of dirt and material from the moon, you know, surface from this sunless crater, maybe 10 miles high. All that material sees sunlight for the first time in God knows how many millions or billions of years. It vaporizes. The instrumentation on La Crosse detects it, detects the water, which is what they're really looking for, because water on the moon costs, I mean, what's the most expensive mineral water that you can buy anywhere on Earth, George? All neatly packaged in a crystal bottle and everything?
It costs Evian and everything else.
Yeah,
all right.
I actually went out and looked. The most expensive bottle of water you can get costs between $40 and $50, okay, for a pound of water in a little bottle.
That's a lot of money.
Water on the moon will cost $50,000 per pound if we have to import it from Earth with stupid rockets to build a lunar base. So if you find water on the moon, if you find water at the North Pole or the South Pole of the moon in these permanently shadowed craters, you have drastically, dramatically, incredibly sliced by factors of thousands the cost of establishing human beings in some kind of an outpost on the moon.
And we know they have found uranium there.
Yeah, that's kind of useful further down the road. Actually, you want to go solar energy. You don't want to go nukes on the moon for a whole bunch of reasons, but that's another show. So anyway, the La Crosse spacecraft is following along, and in 4 minutes, it impacts the moon. It's a kamikaze mission, but not before it is sent in real time the data, this priceless, precious data, back to Earth, back to Ames, back to the scientists and the technicians and the computers and the whole NASA network, and also all the ground-based observatories that will be looking and recording with their spectrometers aimed at this point on the moon, including Hubble. The refurbished Hubble is really going to come into its own with this mission, because if we find the water that they're expecting, it dramatically and totally changes the price of going into space in every imaginable direction if, and this is the big if, you are limited to clunky, primitive rockets. Because water on the moon can be made into rocket fuel. And
is
that
there,
rocket fuel will take you anywhere.
Well, you know, Zubrin has said this in the past with regards to Mars.
Yes.
If we can terraform Mars one day, can we do that to the moon or not?
Well, yeah, of course. If you have the materials, you live off the land. I mean, this is axiomatic. I mean, Lewis and Clark did not carry...
But can we create a true atmosphere on the moon?
You don't need to. You build domes. Duh. That's why they built the domes in the first place, George.
I know. Would you want to live in a dome?
Well, it depends on the size of the dome. Remember, a dome on the moon, you know, is if it's big enough, you can actually fly with human muscle power. You can strap wings on your arms, and you can fly on the moon.
I watched them build a domed stadium here in St. Louis years ago for the football team, for the Rams that we got from L.A. It took years and equipment and people. How are they going to build this stuff on a far-off land?
Well, don't think 19th century. Think 21st. It'll be done with nanotechnology, little computer-controlled robots, things that automatically chew up moon dirt and spit out glass and form it and shape it, and it'll all be done by robotic remote control. You won't need one Mohawk, you know, to build the high rises on the moon as you have had build them in New York and Chicago and elsewhere on Earth.
And I guess we'll be sending pods up there too, and they just hook them together.
What do you mean for living spaces?
Yeah.
Well, initially, but ultimately, you'll basically be mining the moon. Now, remember, this is in the NASA standard scenario. In the Enterprise scenario, there's a huge amount of already manufactured stuff that can be, you know, you simply plug it in and turn on the lights, and bingo, you've got instant civilization, which, of course, is the reality. All of this is pretense. Remember, the NASA you think you have is not the NASA that really exists. It's a false front Western town. It's to keep us all occupied, thinking this is how we explore and inhabit and colonize space. Where the real space program, the secret program, which we will talk at great length about in future shows with more evidence, it God knows where it could be tonight. You could have human beings with outposts on Pluto, for God's sake, waving at NASA's Horizon spacecraft as it flies by in 10 years. That's the disparity between what we get to see and what they don't let us see. And I know that Jerry and others and I participated in endless meetings about private space programs. Oh, we need to get NASA out of the game. We need to get private industry, you know, like you know, Elon Musk now and Bert Rutan and those guys. But remember, those guys themselves are not talking about anything really interesting and big. They're talking about mucking around the edges of the new ocean, as Kennedy called it, in Earth orbit, where we have been doing precisely nothing for 40 years. We closed down going to the moon, George. Why did we stop going to the moon?
Well, we never know. Some say because we were told.
Well, my bet is because they couldn't. Look, if you have enough missions, at some point the secret's going to slip. Not everybody can be bought. Not everybody can be paid off. Not everybody can be brought into the club. At some point, some credible person will scavenge the evidence, will hold a news conference, and the game is up.
And be a whistleblower.
A big one.
As now, the FAA just said, by the way, last week, that most of the whistleblowers that the FAA didn't say it, but it came out of an investigation. Most of the FAA whistleblowers were telling the truth. The FAA never did anything about it.
Interesting. What,
so it's probably the same in NASA and every other agency.
Look, this is what your first guest in the first hour was talking about. The trend curve is really bad unless there is a game changer. There needs to be a stunning global game changer. Why do you think, George, that I have stayed on the pursuit of ancient extraterrestrial civilizations for decade after decade after decade? Don't you think I could make $1 million? Don't you think I could write 15 novelettes or novels?
Oh, sure, but that and I know you're not a millionaire. That I know. I'll be back in a moment. Let's talk about these ancient civilizations.